Okay, welcome to this meeting of the CUC. Today we're going to have two presenters from ICS. Riyadh Ziani, who's going to talk about creating a single resource to access decentralized computer facilities. And later on we're going to have Gabrielle Krim, who I'll introduce separately.
Good time.
Okay, so...
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Anyway, today's presentation is going to be Public Computer Labs, decentralized public computer labs. What we're going to cover today is actually why we needed public lab systems and planning process that went through into developing a system, designing and developing the tool itself, managing data, and measuring performance. And ultimately how to improve this tool for the longer term, of course. Why we need the public lab system, and that's one of the critical questions actually behind this system or being developed, is to allow students to find where labs are located, what software is available, or what hardware even is there for them to use. Where they can print, whether black or color, what labs are private, what labs are public, they're open for everybody, including the support contact and so on. Ultimately, this was geared toward the student community because there are end users. They are the target above all. So we wanted to make sure that the facilities that we have is accessible, easy for them to reach. And on the other hand of the equation, also it provides management with performance related questions, of course. Indicators of number of visitors that access these facilities, the time spent, and what are the busiest times, hours, and days that our people spend in these facilities. So these are actually very important questions that we had to consider what we needed in terms of designing this presentation, presenting this tool. So what was needed in terms of information, what tools we needed to get it to work, where and how to collect this data, how frequently we should do this, by the way. As an example, should we run it at certain events or triggers, or if it's constantly running? And obviously there are underlying questions behind how frequently we do it in terms of processing the work, whether it's done on one machine bearing all the loads versus, you know, distributing the load on different machines. And is it user-friendly? Ultimately, we want to make it sure it's accessible, it's easy to use and navigate. Otherwise, people find it difficult and then they will not use it. Therefore, it'll become a useless tool. Can it be applied to existing structure? This is a very important question. We've been in the industry of teaching for a long time, and we had computers dated so old as well. Can we make it work with what we have? Do we have to make changes, and how much changes do we have to make? So there, all these questions had to be answered. So what we've done is we met with lab managers, lab admins, we've discussed some of these questions, we've gotten feedback on how we can design a tool, what kind of information they needed, and we've came up with what we think right now, actually, is the latest version that we have. And actually, it resembles this. I don't know if anybody visited this site before, but the public computer lab system is designed a navigation on the left side, and the center mainframe there where you can actually navigate through as well. There are different types of navigations, interactive maps, of course. There's a computer finder where you can actually navigate by department or building. Now, one of the important things is that we wanted to relay the information, relate to where these labs are, so we had to come up with also a map, whether it was the location of the building, the location of the lab within that building as well. So looking at an interactive maps, because the campus is scattered downtown and McDonald campus, we had to accommodate for both. And based on selection, people would actually see the GIL map, slightly obviously colored for easy spotting. So as you can see, the red buildings identify where actual labs are. Obviously, they're mixed between public and private. And by accessing any of these labs, as an example, or by clicking on any buildings, you have a list of labs available in that. Now, once you've narrowed down the number of labs, the question comes is, okay, what are the opening hours? What kind of a lab is it? So we've developed this page actually to identify if it's what faculty, what department, the opening hours, and whether it's accessible or not, of course. And ultimately, the operating system. We really depend on the operating system. A lot of us use Windows, and that's great. We have it across campus almost anywhere. But those that need Macs or Linux, it's really hard to tell. Unless you're part of the department itself, then you know where it is. But if you don't, if you're a new student, it is almost impossible to know unless you're told somewhere. So this tool was developed for that purpose. Now, on the other hand, if you don't know where you are on the map, or you know, ideally, you're looking for your particular department, you can go into the computer finder. We can do a search by department, by building, again, or by a software, a particular software that you have interest into. This is a list of almost all departments in McGill. It's honestly very simple. We've tried to make it user intuitive, where you check if you were looking for Windows, Mac, or Linux operating system, whether it's public access or even wheelchair accessible or not. As you do the search again, it's almost similar to looking by building, except for people who are graphically capable, or they like to see the actual map layout, it's easier for them to go that way. But those who prefer to understand or click on what they're looking for in particular, that's a good way of doing it. And actually, you can narrow down more in this way, because you could have the selection of operating system, whether publicly accessible or not. So once the end user have clicked on a lab, they actually present it with information such as what building and room it is, the hours if available, of course, the support unit that provide technical support in case of difficulties at that time that they're in, or if they have, they know where to go. It is almost difficult for people to go into the lab and the labs are not working, to try and look where they can go. If they don't know this offhand, then, you know, they'll be running around the building trying to find someone or asking even the lab manager, which I think it's not always possible that you have a lab administrator or a lab monitor present at the time. Now, on the primary view, what we have to do, there's a lot of information in the system. We have to split it somehow. So the primary, as you go in, you have a layout of the floor indicating how many computers are available in that room. And from there, you can actually navigate through. You have your availability, where you could actually click. Obviously, for security reasons, part of the discussion was is that this information highlights our infrastructure, building structure, where everything is. So we decided to make it somewhat secure. To make it secure, it had to be secure, but not to block everything as well. So the idea is it should be accessible to all McGill people. If you're a McGill employee, students, or staff, you have access to the tool, and you can log in simply using your McGill username and password. I purposefully did not log in before, just to demonstrate that we had to implement security measures to prevent possible threats. And as you access the lab, and obviously you've signed in, you have the lab structure, basically identifying where the machines are located, where the actual printers are, and you have also a legend of what the statuses indicates. You can't reflect text. If we were to use text, it will be a lot of text in a small area, condensed, and we have to also accommodate for the visually impaired in terms of choosing the colors and trying to identify the patterns as well. It was a little bit tricky to identify these patterns. You have a list of softwares, and this is again is to identify the search when you're searching. If you're looking for a Microsoft Office as an example, or SAS or SPSS, these are hard to find softwares, and not every lab is equipped with them. Although now we have a campus agreement to have it installed, they're not deployed everywhere. So they can click on there and access a list of softwares, a list of peripherals in terms of what hardware is available. We're trying to include every hardware that's possible, from a projector to a printer to a scanner. And that is, again, some people have student group projects. They have to do presentations. They need to practice this at times. So identifying these elements for them is really critical. Now, the interface, again, you can always navigate back and forth. You can go back to interactive and look up the McDonald campus. Unfortunately, we only have one building in McDonald campus. It's the hugest building, the McDonald Stewart, which somehow is divided into sub-buildings. But again, at this point, we have three labs in that area that you can access, and it'll be the same concept again. It's a different structure, different layout. It's really tailored based on that lab. And obviously, when this changes, we have to make changes to that. Now, when it comes to developing the tool to make this all work, it comes the question of maintaining it and maintaining the data that comes with it. So managing the public data computers, once again, we're talking about, you know, distributing the work. One person to do the job is a lot of work for an individual. So the system was developed so we allow every unit, every lab administrator to be able to manage their own information. As we saw in the lab, there's what we call public information and private, or other information that they can modify. The information that you see in here are public, that everybody can see. So we allowed the lab managers to be able to make changes instantly. And as they come in here and change those, they'll be able to reflect instantly without having to wait for an update or anything. Now, as they make changes to the actual lab, whether they add a new computer or remove a computer, we're notified of the change in order to accommodate the layouts. Because as you can see, it's an image that reflects the status or the position of the computer in that lab. So it's a combined effort from the lab manager to maintain their day-to-day operations and ours to maintain the layouts and to make sure that it's actually reflecting appropriately. Now, what do we do with all this data? I mean, we have a lot of data to tell us how many people come in, to tell us how often they stay in the lab, and what are the times that they come in. Do they come in during lunchtime? Do they come in after midnight? And so on. So with this, we come to manage reports. We create, and we will be distributing reports that lab managers can run themselves against the data they have for their labs. Unfortunately, we cannot share the data of one lab with another lab manager, so each lab manager has control of their own labs and reports for their own labs. And they'll be able to pull up what months were the busiest times, what times were the busiest, and we've been able to identify patterns in some areas, actually, that we ran reports against already. Now, how does the lab manager can do this? How can they actually manage this data? So what we've done is we've created an interface, a web interface for them to be able to log in and also manage their information. So as they come in here, again, they have to sign in. It's a different interface. It is a different address as well. Let's just say no. So they're presented with this view where it allows them first to either manage an existing lab or create a new lab. We don't always create new labs. I think we're pretty settled with the number of labs we have. If we do anything, we just change the lab or the lab structure, move it from one building to another, and so on. So I will not discuss the adding of a new lab right now, but we'll go through the managing one of the existing labs as an example. So they're presented with a drop-down list. This list will present all the labs that they have access to. This changes from lab manager to another. And as they pick their selection and they click on go, they're presented with the existing public data. Again, we spoke about public data was presented in the previous view, and that is whether it's downtown campus with the name of the building, faculty, hours, operating system, and so on. But then they're presented with the option of changing. They can change that information, and as they change it here, it instantly reflects on the interface. So we don't have to wait for that delay. And the importance of developing this was to make it dynamic. We don't want to always go back and have to do it again or three people performing the work. We wanted to a simple change reflect the changes everywhere that's needed. Now, we've managed, or the lab manager would have been able to modify the public data. They're also able to manage the existing computers in that lab. And on this interface, as you can see, it illustrates the computer name and the current status of that lab. As you can see, the green represented available computers for use, and red, those are computers are not, they're being occupied at this moment. So from this interface, they can add new computers. They simply by entering the computer name. That's obviously when you're deploying new computers, if you acquire new machines, you do that. You can also do this when you're replacing an existing machine as well. Now, you can also modify names on machines. Like I said, you can delete an existing one and add a new computer name, or you can simply rename it. And renaming it is as simple as selecting which one you wish, and you can modify it. And making the changes here, again, it's an instant change. The only thing that that needs to be done after is for us to modify the lab structure. Once again, the map is a static information. So it reflects that that computer number two is positioned in the corner, so we need to go and make sure that the computer in the corner is reflecting the new name. And that's we're automatically notified as soon as the lab manager makes a change on this interface. Now, the out-of-service option here is basically when there's a problem, we need to reflect that also to the end user. If there's only in one lab five computers, three of them are down, it's almost useless for the student to try and go and get a machine because three of them are down right now, and it'll be a waste of time and effort. So hope we don't have any five computer labs, but it allows them here to make sure they announce it ahead of time, or they announce it to the people that are trying to access the lab at that moment. They'll say, okay, these machines are out of service, and then you just tag it as out of service. What that means, it reflects the change on the page. By the way, it's an instant change as well. I do not wish to do it on this lab because it's a live lab and realistic lab too. But it will do it. It will put in the computer with the X outlining that it's an out-of-service one. Okay. Once the computer is done out of service, it can't be brought back in service through this interface. And the reason is a technician is always present on the lab, on site, trying to fix that computer. And as soon as they fix the issue and they log into it, it's reported as resolved. Very rare that you'll see an issue that's, okay, the first time it wasn't fixed, they'll have to revisit it the next day and so on, unless it's a malfunction of hardware that they need to order equipment for. Now, with the change of labs, what happened is that, okay, we had 15 labs and we need to remove two of them. Either they're outdated or we're not getting the funding to add new labs, so we need to remove these two computers. They can come in and delete it from here. Once again, deleting it from here will only remove it from the management tool, but it has to be removed from the web page in order to, again, represent where is it in the physical structure. We've added the buttons to select all if need be or not to select anything at all. And again, they can always go back to the managing the information. With this interface, again, because it's always going back and forth, making changes to either one lab or many labs, we always want it that way to return to where we started from. And from here, again, they can just start picking a new lab to modify, or even just create a new lab. The creation of the new lab, again, the first thing, obviously, when you want to create a lab, is you identify, okay, where's the lab going to be, or what's the name of it. There are some standards that we would like to maintain in order to facilitate the work now and in the future. But again, people are not bound, because what we said is that it had to fit what we have right now. So even somebody doesn't come in with a new lab that does not meet the standards, it's still feasible to put it on that tool to make it accessible to the public as well. Now, we took this project to EDUCAUSE this actually last year, and surprisingly, we got a lot of feedback about the project because a lot of them were lab administrators, lab owners. They run research facilities and so on, and they wanted to know how often they're being used. Obviously, and ideally, is that they want to know, do we have the equipment to meet the needs of these people? Do we have the proper or latest software or hardware to meet this? And again, when you collect data for all the computers, you're identifying patterns. Part is a human nature. As an example, the machine closest to the door are the most accessible ones, or the most frequently used ones, versus the one at the very, very end. So a lot of them actually wanted to deploy something like this. They didn't have it in place, and they want to do this. And we're hopefully that they'll be able to use this tool or similar tools. We're not saying that this tool doesn't exist already. There's some things already done. We've chosen to develop the tool ourselves. And the reason for developing it ourselves, first, we had to make it fit within our environment. We had to make sure that it's maintenance-wise. A lot of it that you buy, you have your maintenance costs, your purchase cost, renewal costs, and so on. And then again, most of these renewal costs are per machines. Fortunately, we don't have to do this. It's not in this case. Now, with this system, although it works right now, it always requires improvements. We're always geared to improving the student experience at McGill and also the staff, instructors, and professors. So the way to do this, we have, like I said, we've met all with the lab managers to understand their needs to develop it, but also we get the user feedbacks, the students' feedbacks, whether the machines are not accessible, maybe it's frequently down. We track the frequency of it being out of service as well to see if maybe it's time to change it. And again, based on this, we check what the desired functionality, whether it was the end user that they wanted to know something that the tool does not reflect right now, or is it the lab manager that they want to keep track of or want to introduce to the people as well. And again, we have a lot of raw data, okay? But you can run different kinds of reports. You choose the type of reports. Most of them are going to revolve around the frequency, the duration, the comparison between 1 year to another, as an example, and also comparing one semester or 1 month compared to another one. I mean, it was a short presentation, and I want it to be that way because we're only talking about what's there, and maybe it's a one-sided communication, but I hope it was insightful. If you have any questions regarding the tool, the development of the tool, do not hesitate to let me know. I'm here to answer questions. And can also send an email to support.isd@mcgill.ca, and I'll be glad to respond to your questions.
How much do you rely on? I mean, when you first started rolling this out, I assumed you collected information
Yes.
to fill in. But now it's pretty much you don't have to do that. They are pretty much keeping it up to date, the lab managers.
Right. Well, in order to introduce this project to lab managers to have them shift gears toward it, we had to do the initial work. So we've delegated staff to visit every lab and lab manager to identify the software, hardware, the location, and the layout of the lab. So kind of made the work for them easy to start. Now, it's a combined effort, like I said. To make it work, we all have a hands in it. They have the tool. We have the tool to make it work and to make the changes that's needed. So, again, we took the responsibility of developing, and it was a lot of work at the start, to tell you the truth.
Well,
the buildings that were listed,
yes.
And we don't have labs in every building, but most of the buildings that we have, they're listed in here. We needed to make sure that once we've collected it, to put that responsibility on the lab managers as well, because again, for one side to always run after people, they're not always available, they're occupied. We all have our own duties, our own things to perform. We have to be present at meetings, so they're not always accessible. So they have to make sure that they're there. They have it, they can do it at their own time, of course, and it's accessible to them through the web. It's not you have to go somewhere else to do this. And we try to structure it easily. It won't be a complicated something, a new learning experience like Banner. Sorry. yes?
Hi, I'm from the library, like Susan. I noticed a couple of things, obviously, more important because people are local, stuff, but one thing that struck me is the hours, where you say you have the hours
yes.
that are available in the library. Our hours change throughout the year.
Yes.
And rather than having to constantly keep that information up to date, and it varies from location to location, would it be possible to put a link there to our library website pages where we spell out all the hours of service instead of having to remember to go in and change it?
Absolutely. The system is capable of doing that. There has been well, there was a request to make something like this happen. One of the, again, is dynamic data, so we always can make it triggered based on the time of year. As an example, if I wanted the lab to reflect the hours for next week, because it's going to be, let's not speak of next week, but as in December for the Christmas, the opening hours are totally different. So we can say, okay, for the duration of Christmas, you change the hours automatically. I know it's, the issue is that whether they can make it, right now it's done manually, they have to change it. If they have to do it manually right now, they're only doing it twice, three times a year, maybe for lab. I'm not diminishing the idea, but it is doable to link to an outside.
But it's still something then that we have to remember to go in and change. And in some cases, our hours are dependent on things like exam schedules that we don't know.
Absolutely.
In advance that we could just build it in. So I think we'd really appreciate just linking back instead of doing doubling, you know, duplicating the work we're already doing.
We're absolutely, I mean, these are links that are, right now they're tied into the system, but we can link to any location. As an example of that idea is what we've done is the location of this building. Once you click, maybe not. If you're not sure of the location of this building, or once you've entered here, you actually go back, you're able to go back to the McGill map, identifying where it's on the map itself. And as you can see here, it says finding the building on campus. So as you click on this, it will take you to the page picking up that particular building, by the way. And as you can see, there's the data from McDonald Stewart as an example. We are able to do this, whether it is a static page that is on the library webpage or it exists elsewhere. As you can see, this one is it changing, of course. As you can see, it also changes by the building ID. So we have to integrate this system into the existing system, which is the Gateway's web map. We could plug it into Google Maps as well.
But from from McDonald campus, I noticed you don't have the library computers there.
That's right.
Sorry, I don't mean to be complaining. It's very good. It's very nice.
No, I'd have to say for the McDonald campus, they did not present us with the library yet.
Who are they?
The department that's supposed to dismantle the information to us in order for us to make it possible. But I understand there was one library in there that's not in here. And like I said, we started off with this project with actually two labs only. Two labs that we managed. It was very easy to create an interface for two labs. And then all of a sudden, in a short period of time, every lab had to be using this. So, yes, we have missed on that library, for sure.
I was a lab manager in my past life, so that's what I choose. Because when I was a lab manager, we were always... I didn't see a question on there which says, what student has a right to use this for free, for pay, for, you know, if you speak nicely to your friend? I mean, it seems to me, you said faculty of science, for example, but sometimes faculty of science are open to anybody who logs in, and sometimes they're restricted. So I just wonder if you're thinking of putting in a field which would say, you know, if you're an arts student, you can go to the Ferrier Lab, but if you're a science student, I think you can't log in unless you pay. But if you pay, you can. So
absolutely.
It seems to me there should be something that would say available for this price, available for free, available never ever grad students, undergrad, you know. That's another dimension which is really important, and I think it's still not totally unified across all these.
That is a true statement. In fact, some labs are accessible to only departments. Some are accessible if you're taking a particular course. And as you can see in the hours of operations, it says 24/7. But again, this is not true. You still have to have your access card. And in that case, it outlines, yes, it's open in the opening hours, but after hours you can still go as long as you have your access card. We try to make sure that if that information is entered, then it reflects what needs to be. Actually, there are departments, I don't recall what lab in particular, that says you have to be a member of that department, you have to be registered in courses in that faculty. So it does outline it in this interface.
Maria, the access, the field down there where it says restricted by departments allows the lab manager to put that kind of information in. So we did account for it.
They can put it in.
If they don't fill it in, that's what shows.
Thank you. I totally missed that one. Thank you. Yes?
In your stats, how much... Maybe you can tell us, maybe you can't, but how much shopping is there by students looking for free or open spaces in terms of for computers across campus? And is there a lot more cross-fertilization? Are students who normally only are sticking to their local lab looking at other places to get access to computers? There's a lot more movement of students around campus for that?
I'm not sure of how much of or how if I can say anything about numbers in particular, but I could say that the public publicly accessible areas, they're highly dense in terms of usage. I don't look at the exact data myself because I only run the tool and the report to give it to the lab manager to see it. It's they see the reports and they identify it. But what I could tell you is from the general look is that there's a lot of traffic in those publicly accessible areas. And again, there are some people that that I've noticed that will go to, let's say, the faculty of law as an example, that they used to stay there and that they would stay connected for 6 hours at a time. Mind you, yes, they may have been the graduate students, right? But it reflects on, obviously, if they're grads or undergrads, and how long they stay connected and how long they stay in here. One of the things is that obviously is that, okay, there are, have been students that are coming into the lab today, logging in and using the computer for X number of hours, and then they just go and come back to the same machine the next day. Either they never logged off and they continue using it, or again, they they have some data on that particular computer or software that they need to come back to it. So you start identifying these patterns. Why this particular machine that is highly used versus, you know, the one in the corner? Is it because it's connected to a scanner, as an example? Is it because they have SPSS that others don't have? I don't wish to overrun my time. I do apologize for that. But again, if you have any questions, please send an email. I'll be pleased to answer them for you. And I'll pass the stage to my colleague.
Thank you very much, Riyadh. And now we have Gabrielle Krim, who's going to talk about looking for IT answers, browse our service catalog. Gabrielle was particularly helpful in getting me to put a hyperlink to the knowledge base. So if you're looking at this live online, you just click on the knowledge base article to get information about how to ask questions. So if there's any questions, we hope they come rolling in from people who are watching this live.
Thank you
very much,
Gabriel. Okay, thank you, Gordon. Okay, so anyway, I think I should have been doing this before, which is to close off Riyadh's presentation. Okay, that's not it. Excuse me. Okay. Just a moment. Okay. Looking for IT answers, browse our service catalog. So, my name is Gabrielle. I'm a technical writer with the ICS IT Customer Support Unit of IT Services. And I'll be presenting this topic, which is a combination of the IT services page and the IT knowledge base. So what we mean by a service catalog is a way of looking at IT services that allows end users to browse through and find the IT services they need, find everything about IT services, and use it as they would a product catalog from a company. So without further ado, this presentation, as the previous one, was given at CanHeight and at EDUCAUSE, and this is a picture of our group. It's Kim, Hun, Denise Nahas, Michael Sampson, and myself. And we're standing in front of the posters that you see behind me, which were presented at the EDUCAUSE 2008 conference. The topics we'll be discussing today are the spider web. What we mean by a spider web, I'll be showing you soon. It's the history behind the service catalog, why we felt we needed one, and how we developed it. We'll discuss the structure of the contents, how we came up with the different categories that we present in the service catalog. We'll take a behind-the-scenes look at the workflow and how we maintain our content, how we enter it. And we'll look at some of the measurements we use for successfully achieving our goals and some of the improvements that we've been working towards since the project was launched and what we're going to be doing moving forward. The spider web. This quote is from the abstract of the presentation. It says, McGill IT consolidated several disparate websites containing thousands of notes, instructions, and reference articles into one unified knowledge base centered around our service offerings. Here's something you'll be quite familiar with. It's the IT services organizational chart, and it's here to demonstrate just how many IT services units there are. These separate units are all service providers. They provide things like telephones, email, Minerva banner and those administrative systems, the website. These are all IT services that we provide to the McGill community. And in the center of it all, we have the IT customer services, which is our unit, and we are the central contact point for all customers seeking support on these services. So it fell onto our responsibility to provide the end users with this way of accessing support on all the IT services. Originally, based on all of these separate units within IT services, every unit had its own website, and they still do. We still have our own unit websites, but the IT services were scattered amongst these unit websites. So you had the NCS site, the content collaboration site, the ICS site, which was providing supporting documentation for all these other services. And it was confusing to end users because they didn't know where to look to find out how to get a service, how to approach, how to get a complete picture of all the things that were available to them. So they didn't know where to go for information. When they did find the information, it was often long-winded. It might have included the whole history of how the service had evolved over the years and was sometimes very difficult to find the meat of the information, what they really needed to get to quickly. There was also overlap between the websites. As I was mentioning, for instance, in this diagram you see here, the NCS websites and the ICS websites. They're very similar in structure. They have the same service offerings in the menus down the sides, but in different orders. Sometimes you'd have an article on NCS that was about, you know, how to get the service and how to what the service is, and then it would hyperlink to a page in ICS on best practices to use that service, or a how-to article, a how-to page with instructions. And so the user was bounced around from one site to another, getting lost, not understanding that he had actually switched to a whole different departmental site. So the navigation was also confusing, and we wanted to resolve this. So we decided to have this, what we called the Unified IT Services site. And the goal of the site was to enhance the user experience, give them quick access to directly what they needed to find the service they wanted, access the support on that service, figure out how to use it. We wanted it to be a one-stop shop, a single page where they could find everything they needed. We also wanted to present the services in a consistent way. So, you know, rather than having multiple parties editing their own content, we wanted to have a single way to present all the services that would give users a familiar feeling no matter what they were looking for, so they'd know what to expect. And by having all the information and content go through a single source, it would be easier for us to maintain as well, to keep up to date and have, a single source. One of the first attempts we had at an IT services page looked like this. You might not even be familiar with it because I don't think that it was very well advertised or publicized. It wasn't a really attractive page. It was simply a collection of frequently asked questions grouped by service categories. It didn't really revolve around the notion of a service catalog where you present the picture from A to Z. How is this service, you know, what does it look like, what does it smell like, who can access it? And so this first attempt really, you know, I mean, it was a step in the right direction, but it didn't really get us there. Once the user clicked on any of these links, he would simply go back to the pages of that NCS or ICS site and find the information and then be lost amongst that labyrinth of web pages. So at the same time, while we were thinking about the unified website and the service catalog, we also had a parallel project going on, which was the IT knowledge base. The knowledge base was the aim of it, the original aim, was for troubleshooting and to be used by the ICS service desk. But we quickly realized that a lot of the information would also be needed by the general public. And why not store the information that we were going to be presenting for this service catalog right into that knowledge base? So we decided to use the knowledge base as a repository for all the information, all the content. Okay, so because the knowledge base was now going to be a public tool, not just to be used by the service desk, it needed to satisfy certain criteria for the general public. It needed to be searchable, it needed to have a good search functionality, it needed to be a robust tool, not crashing all the time, and it needed to have the ability to customize the interface, to brand it to McGill so that people could feel that they didn't all of a sudden step out into customer support land in some other organization. And these are the things that we had experimented with an internal knowledge base that was linked to our heat ticketing system. It was a free tool. We had experimented with that. We also made it available to the public, but it didn't work. It didn't solve these criteria, so we went searching for another tool, and we ended up with the knowledge base that we use today. This is a look at the current IT services page that we have. It provides this single access point to IT services. All of the services are listed on this page. You can browse to the IT services or search through the knowledge base using the search boxes up here. And you can also view events, features, and announcements at the bottom of the page. So I'll click and hopefully get to a quick demo of this. So the page opens, and you can only see the top part of it. We'll look at this later about the issues that we have with this page. But you have a bunch of folders here that are closed, and right now the index of all the IT services is open, so you can always hit a service listed in alphabetical order. Or you can, if you're more of a, you know, want to browse by category, you can open up the service categories here, and then you see the listing of relevant services within each category. Maybe email and calendaring is an easier one to start with. So within email and calendaring, we've split up things into email for affiliates, email for alumni, email for faculty and staff, the students. And these are different services because they present the same flavors of a service, but they have different ways of accessing them, different specific questions to go with them and set up instructions, things like that. And each of these, when you open them, they link to the knowledge base. So this is a glimpse of the knowledge base, and I'll be looking at it later. So back to my slides. We'll look at the structure of contents. What we wanted to do is develop a structure that mirrors what the our typical end users were looking for, not the way that we saw our services, not from that provider perspective, like NCS does this, ICS does that, Content and Collaborations does this. We wanted to, all the users are looking for services that they need. They don't care who's providing them. They don't care, you know, so much about the supporting units. They just want to get them. And so we did a focus group. We first categorized all the services based on the categories that we had already had in our HEAT ticketing system, because ICS support, customer support system had already classified services in a certain way. And then we built the page based on that and then validated it using a focus group. And the focus group consisted of faculty members from different departments, students, and administrative staff. So we had multiple viewpoints and multiple interests in the focus group. And this helped us determine some of the naming conventions, some of the ways that things were grouped. For instance, we have a category here called My McGill, Minerva, Banner, etc., or I think it's and other systems in the actual page. And that one had started off as business and administrative systems. And in the focus group, we found that people didn't relate to that at all. And in another one, we have now web publishing, hosting, and wikis, whereas the original name for that category was collaborative solutions. You know, so we did, in the focus group, we asked them to answer certain questions, to find information and see which categories they actually looked under to find that information. So we saw their behavior, and we also then had a discussion portion where they voiced their opinions of what they liked better. And we got a little bit of feedback about the navigation on the site as well through those users. For instance, these plus signs that we've added here were not there in the beginning, and they didn't realize that you had to click to open the folders. So the focus group was an invaluable part of making this tool live. It was a really great step. So to reiterate, the core services are logins and passwords, email and calendaring, telephone, network, wireless, computer and software, My McGill Minerva Banner, teaching and learning, audiovisual and multimedia, web publishing, hosting and wikis, IT security best practices, and the service desk and training. And you'll see that this core IT services structure is reflected also in the knowledge base. In fact, we built the knowledge base on these small knowledge bases within, and so that, as you can see, there's some blue folders on the side here, and they represent the core services. And here you can also, when you're doing your search, you can put in keywords here, and you can also search and narrow it down to one of the core services if you know that that's what you're looking for. And the folder structure, when you open it up, if you click the first level, you see all the service descriptions within that folder. So here I think it's the telephone networks, and you can see computer network security, cell phones, purchases, and these are all primary services that are offered there that give you the overview of how to purchase or how to request a service, how to access it, frequently asked questions, and the general overview of what the service is and who can access it. And then within the folders, the yellow folders underneath, there's a one for each of those services, and those contain the supporting articles, such as how to configure something and how to set it up. Yeah, I'm missing something here. Oh, these are the way that each service is described. Each service is described through a template, so they all follow the same structure. They all start with a description, have a section on who can use the service. Then they have the how to request and access the service, which usually links to more detailed articles that describe how to set up a particular operating system and a particular software to use the service. And then you have, if I scroll down, I wonder if I can... Wait, I was just going to show it actually in live mode. Scroll down, and I have the who can use the service and how to access the service. And then I have costs. Most of them are part of McGill pays for the cost, so there's no additional cost. You have information on the availability, and then you have information on specific questions that people come up with frequently about the service, best practices, links to training, courses that are given, or self-serve resources, and supporting information. So all of the services in our catalog are formatted the same way, they're structured the same way, and this makes it easy for users to know that once they access a service, they know that they can, once they locate a service in the knowledge base and on the IT page, they know that they're going to be able to find this information, and they'll always have a contact point at least. So I think if I go like this, it should... I'm not used to PowerPoint, sorry. Okay, we're next here. Okay, so we saw what a service description looked like. Now, there are other supporting articles that are also in the knowledge base, and they are usually those kinds of setup instructions, how to use something. Here you have set up a BlackBerry device for wireless and email. You have break-fix articles where something goes wrong, it's not expected, and we have documented solutions for those problems. So you have we typically give you the context of the problem, or the environment, the problem, and causes. And this demonstrates the different kinds of templates that we developed in the knowledge base. So each, when I get into the workflow, maybe that'll be more obvious. And speaking of the workflow, here it is. We're going to take a behind-the-scenes look at how the content is entered and maintained in the knowledge base. We have an administrative interface, and this allows us to access articles, create articles, edit articles. This is the article management section. And here you have a WYSIWYG editor. You also have a source panel pane that shows you the HTML source code. So it's just like any other web page. But when you go to create a new article, the first step in creating it is choosing a template. So you'd choose, if it's a service description, it's going to have all of those sections in it. If it's a break-fix article, it's another kind of template. And a reference article is a simple vanilla template with one style, and you can add anything you want. You know, it's very supports a lot of different HTML. And then you have also a web file manager in this tool that lets you put in your images and keep track of PDF documents and other supporting documents that may be in separate files. And you have an FAQ management section where you can manage the frequently asked questions in a different way. And other tools, the glossary, and it's quite a rich interface. Once we've entered an article, we add these properties to it so that it can appear in the knowledge base in the way that we want it to. The category puts it into one of those yellow folders on the side. I don't know if you recall how that looked. So if I choose the category for this, and I can put it into multiple categories as well, but that basically puts it into a folder. I can add priority keywords. So in this case, it's for the BlackBerry article. So we put Sync and Pocket PC and PDA in case people look under these things if they want to search for it, and that word doesn't appear in the article. If it's in one of these priority keywords, it will be found. And the frequently asked questions, you can put multiple frequently asked questions on an article, and that also helps to promote it higher in the search results. And then finally, we have related articles, which allow us to link one article to another. And there's two ways to link. One is within the body of the article, and that's just an HTML hyperlink. And then the other way is to have these related articles that are that appear on the side. They would appear here in this view. There aren't any in this view right now, but when you open one of the articles, the related articles appear here. So what those properties do for the end user is they affect the search results. For instance, I had an FAQ linked to that article, and I searched on Pocket PC. Now I have the FAQ up on top, so it's more easily noticeable by end users instead of getting lost in the myriad of search results that could come out. And in addition, the priority keywords also make this article stand out above others that might have those same keywords in them. And you also have a little relevancy weighting bar on the side here that indicates how well this article matches. That's a suspect feature. It depends on, it's a very complicated algorithm to determine which articles are the most relevant based on your keywords, because it takes into consideration a lot of factors like the length of the article versus how many words match your keyword, and the most recently updated articles have a higher weighting. So there's a lot that goes into the weighting, and it's to be taken with a grain of salt. And the service descriptions here are labeled also. As you can see here, it says article type is a service description. So that's something that we code in manually in order to highlight those and bring them up, you know, make them more visible in the search results. So now we'll look at the workflow we've developed. How do we get the information that we put into our knowledge base? Where does this information come from? Well, it comes from all the IT units, from you guys, essentially. And one of the more, well, the way that the articles were originally written, the service descriptions all came from the service providers. But now that we're in the phase of maintaining and updating existing information, a lot of the new information actually comes derived from the ICS service desk, where the end users report their problems or ask questions. So they are a large source of our new information and content. So the ICS service desk interacts directly with the end users. That makes them the key players. They have to capture the issues from the user's perspective. When they're on the phone or if they get an email, they document exactly how the user perceives his problem. Not how, oh, we know that the fix is this, but what is the problem? What would a person search on? What are they looking to resolve? Because this contextual information is really important to keeping our articles relevant to users. They have to understand when they come across an article, say, oh yes, that's the one that is going to answer my problem here. And in the heat ticket tracking system, the ICS service desk records an article. You can't really see the flow chart, but it says that they have to look into the knowledge base first, find out what's written there. If there's an article that answers the person's requests, record that article number in the heat ticket. If there's no article that matches the person's request or the information in the knowledge base is wrong, then they have to either assign it to ICS tech writers or do something else, which I think is on the next page. This is just showing that the heat tickets are categorized basically in the same way that the ICS, that the IT services are categorized. So you have the main arching category called email and calendaring, and the service email for alumni. And then, the next box here highlighted is the KB article number. So that's where they record the number that matches the person's request. And that's where they record it. And in this situation, if they believe that an article should be created and it's missing from the knowledge base, they go and do an auto task. It's right in here in the menu, and they simply say click for a KB article, flag for KB article. They click that button, and then it gets assigned to the ICS service desk team leads, and then they resolve the issue, they find out what the steps are, all the technical details, and then pass it off to the ICS tech writers, who then create the article or update an existing article. Right, and they also can, anyone, second tier or service providers, can also contact ICS tech writers through this email address, icstechwriters@campus.mcgill.ca. So, did we get what we wanted? Let's see how we've measured up to our expectations. First, we have these observations that we've made. The whole knowledge base and service catalog project team, the technical writers and service desk representatives who are on the part of that team, development team, took a knowledge-centered support training course given here at McGill by a consultant. And the result of that course, it was a two-day training. We learned quite a lot about the typical knowledge-centered support approach. And the expert confirmed that we were on the right track with our workflow and with our existing knowledge-based structure. So we were very happy about that. It's really not a very conservative approach to using a knowledge base that we have, because we've not only documented issues and problems and how-to articles, we also have the core services described in there, and that's kind of a different way of approaching a knowledge base. It's using it as the main primary source of information on a topic. So they were we had differences in ideas about how things should be documented. But when he saw what we had done with it, it was very, he was really happy with the way that we had presented the information and the way that we had customized the templates in the knowledge base tool. It was a different approach than he had seen in other universities, or not other universities, other service desks, because mostly the knowledge-centered support is implemented by service desks and not typically by university, but that could be changing soon. He encouraged us to capture content from the bottom up, keep capturing content from the service desk, who is the closest to the end users, and another observation is that the IT service providers know that they have to contact ICS tech writers to update information. So that was a good thing that came out of the year since we launched this thing. Everybody knows the mechanisms behind updating content. And now all our IT units and the CIO and various other departments, enrollment services, are willing to put links to the knowledge base articles in their communications and in their websites. So it's become an integral part of a mainstream source of information at McGill instead of just a web page. And that was a kind of a big hurdle to get people to go into the knowledge base instead of a web page. We have some reports that come directly out of the tool, which are quite interesting. This report shows the overall usage of the knowledge base from January 2008 to June 2008, and you can see that it grew steadily. It was introduced in about December, January, and it grew steadily over those months. June, it was only half the month or a couple of maybe a week, so that's why it's a shorter line here. But the average usage around this time was 30,000. And now you can see that this year, from September to February, the average usage is about 60,000. So it's really doubled. The graphs are not to scale. Here you can see some peaks at the beginning of the semester. Here in September, it's peaked a little bit, and in January, it peaked quite a lot. And the peaks show a normal increased usage at the beginning of the semester, but this one in particular shows it was because there was an issue with the MyMcGill portal, and all of the requests to go to the portal were redirected to the knowledge base article. But even after I accounted for that, I'll show you on the next page. So you can see the hit count, and I think this is January's article hit rate. And the My McGill portal article was number one in that month. It was 93,000 hits on that one article. But even if I took those away from this graph here, it still showed that there were 200,000 hits on the knowledge base. So that's quite a large increase, and it shows quite a lot of activity. I think that's successful. We recently changed the way that users submit feedback through the knowledge base, and we have a feedback browser that collects all of their comments for us. The majority of the comments are actually support issues so far, but we are able to now track these very well. We have a column for status, the article, it tracks the article that they were looking at when they reported the feedback, who it's from, and we can sort on all these fields, and we can keep track of how we're answering these people and managing them. And then there are some other things that we've observed. The service desk says they have faster resolutions by giving people answers from the knowledge base. So they don't have to make up the answer on the fly. The answers given are more consistent because they quote directly from the knowledge base. They even supply the article numbers to their customers. In the heat ticket tracking system, as you remember, there was a place for them to input the knowledge base number that corresponded, so we can have reports about how many articles, how many heat tickets were resolved through the knowledge base articles. And the new service desk hires, it's a great source of learning for them. So as we have a high turnover in the ICS service desk, a lot of students, seasonal workers, they can quickly get up to speed by browsing through the knowledge base. They can be productive right away by locating the information that's there. And if 50 or more percent of calls can be answered by the knowledge base, they're automatically productive, even without having much experience. So these are kind of the improvements that we have been making since we launched the tools. And the first one is on our IT services page. We had originally put the search the knowledge base box here, and the CIO brought it to our attention that it was buried in the page. No one really saw it, looked at it. And so we made it much more prominent by putting it up at the top here. And we also added another field called Go to Specific Article Number so that we could just share internally, say, go to the knowledge base and look for this number. So we could, you know, just say, plug in this number to the IT services page and you go directly to the information. That's one improvement. Second one is that the tool, the knowledge base, once you're in it, the browser address bar will give you information that contains the session information. And so if you try to simply copy this URL and send it, it would never work because it times out and it's really specific to the user at that machine. So we developed a small hyperlink here where they can just click this and it gives you in your paste buffer the correct URL, and then you can paste that into an email, and it only works on IE. That's the only drawback. So it's a good way for us to distribute the correct URL, so it makes life a lot easier. Another improvement that we made just recently is by taking the comments box that was on the side of the articles and moving it into a more prominent place, and also changing it so that it now can give the user a way to enter his email address or prompt them to enter the email address and username. It's not required, but what we were getting was all these questions coming into the old feedback using this suggestions button box, and no way to answer these people because they didn't supply us with their email address. So now we have a much more efficient system and we can track who we're answering and what we're giving them. And a lot of them are actually going back into heat because they're real support issues. So that's, again, the look at that feedback browser which I showed earlier. And another improvement that we're looking to make in the near future is to redesign the page again, a small modification, by putting the events, features, and announcements up at the top also. Because on this page, with most of the folders closed, it's not that much of a problem. They're at the bottom, it's okay. But when you come to the page and it looks like this, and your index of services is large, or if we decide to grow our services, if they suddenly grow to a large number, all of that information gets pushed to the bottom and the user is scrolling forever, if they even bother to look for those kinds of information. And we want the features, the announcements, to be prominent. So that's a redesign that we're going to be implementing very soon. We're also upgrading to a new version of Talisma, and the new version will give us a better control of the searching. It's a different search, completely different search engine in the new version, and we're going to work with the consultants in the Talisma company to integrate it with the McGill's Google search engine. There's a few technical details that need to be worked out, and interface to that engine is not automatic, so we need to work on that. And with this new search engine, or the new implementation, we will be able to have a federated search, which is ability to search and access other knowledge bases outside of our own. So in case we need to access Microsoft or Adobe or other software vendors, we'll be able to take advantage of their knowledge bases. So what are the activities that we're going to be needing to do to move forward? Well, I'll be wrapping up quickly. Well, these are some of the things we started already, but we're also going to keep on going with. Advertising the existence of these tools. We've already begun distributing links to, well, the IT services page, of course, in all our printed materials, in our brochures that we send to students and staff at the beginning of the year, and our posters. They all contain the link to www.mcgill.ca/IT, which is the IT services page, the gateway to that whole knowledge base. And we're also distributing links to the articles in emails from the ICS service desk to clients, and in McGill Channel's announcements, and in other email communications. So we're making use of these pages as if they were real web pages. And the metrics, the reports that I showed you earlier, right now the ICS tech writers have been distributing them through the ICS Alerts email distribution list monthly, but we could make them public, and we're, I guess, thinking of putting those results on a metrics page in the ICS website for users to consult. And these metrics are helpful because they can point out where articles are, where we could use more articles, which areas are the most popular. There's even a report on missed searches, unanswered search terms. So, you know, there's a lot of different things that we can learn, that we can tweak the contents to meet our users' needs more if we understand the reports. And presentations, which I'm giving right now. We did the Can't Hide and EDUCAUSE presentation. I'm doing this one with you to share this among the McGill community. And another development for the knowledge base is that we're offering it enterprise-wide. So right now we have three additional users within the McGill community. The finance department, human resources, and the libraries are starting to build their own knowledge bases using the same tools. So that's you'll look for more, and people will really become used to this way of searching and looking for things. And finally, we want to involve our other IT units to contribute more. We're going to have them, we're training, the content and collaboration team has already been trained, and some of the other units, whoever wants to manage their own content, can be trained to use the administrative interface tool with limited scope of permissions, so that they can't knock the world down, but they can at least edit text. And one of the other things that we need to do on a regular basis is to audit our service descriptions and the content in the knowledge base. So over the year, we should have periodic reviews. We should be distributing to the service providers their content to review and making sure that this gets done so that we can continue to provide up-to-date and accurate information for our users. Thank you for attending. Woo! What happened there? I'll just scroll to it. I'm afraid to start over again. I don't know if that would work. So you can feel free to email me if you have any questions after the presentation. And, of course, if you have any questions now, I'll be happy to take them. Yes?
What's the delay from the time the service desk consultant sends something to a tech writer to put into the knowledge base? What's the time delay there?
We say it's about 2 to 4 days, but it really depends on the complexity of the content. If it's a simple change of a URL or something like that, I mean, it's going to be done, should be within the day. It really also depends on our schedules. There are 4 technical writers, so it's a sizable team, enough to cover what's needed right now. But if it's a complex content and it has to be discussed and tested among the ICS service desk, it might take longer. So, hope that answers your question. Okay, well, if I don't have anything else, then thank you for attending, and I hope we'll maybe you can send us some feedback through the knowledge base.
Thank you.